Erev Tov. So this is the presence in the Jews, part 12. Tonight we're discussing the presence of Willie McKinley, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ilin Ishmas Yonah ben Rai Leib. I begin with handouts for everyone. Special gifts for those who want. I've had these in the office for about 2 years or so. I don't know how they came into my possession, but they're presidential Pez dispensers. See, here's Chester. I just took the four we're discussing now. Here's Chester Arthur. You can fight over it.
No fight.
Grover Cleveland. Benjamin Harrison. And here's tonight's subject, William McKinley. She doesn't dispense Pez. She takes the Pez. All right. Right. And next time the special prize is Theodore Roosevelt. I only have five. With William McKinley, we enter a new chapter in American history, not just the transition to the 20th century, but what can be called the birth of the modern presidency. Three of the next four presidents will shape the presidency in ways that remain extant until today. You could add Franklin Roosevelt to that list also. And few, if any, of the presidents that followed McKinley and Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson would be able to roll back the presidency to what it always was, the chief magistrate, the person charged with executing the laws passed by Congress. William McKinley changed that. And it's highlighted in a book that was just published by Karl Rove, entitled The Triumph of William McKinley, Why the Election of 1896 Still Matters. And he contrasts that election with this election. It's a very interesting read. Of course, most of it relates to our subject tonight, up to the election of McKinley. McKinley's administration was a pivot point in American history and would begin another era of Republican dominance. Beginning in 1896, Republicans won 7 of the next 9 elections. That means 28 out of 36 years, with only the Wilson administration interrupting Republican control over the White House, and that because in 1912, Republican Party split into two. That would be followed, 1932, by 20 years of Democratic supremacy, Roosevelt and Truman, and then, as reflective of a divided, anxious, easily swayed electorate, a rotation every 8 years, with one exception. If you think about it, Truman was followed by Eisenhower for 8 years, Kennedy Johnson for 8 years, Nixon Ford for 8 years, 4 years of Jimmy Carter, the country could stand him no longer, 12 years of Reagan Bush, and then 8 of Clinton, 8 of George W. Bush, 8 of Obama, Democrat, Republican, Democrat. So that's where we are today. If the Republicans win, it won't only be because Obama was perceived as a failed president, but because every 8 years for the last 60 plus, just about, Americans changed the party in power in the White House. Of course, all this is subject to change. William McKinley was president 1897 to 1901. He was the first president to campaign for office, even if he didn't leave his front porch. He was the first to make speeches as to what he would do in office. It was his successor, Teddy Roosevelt, who would be the first to actually campaign among the voters, a lamentable practice that's driving all of us crazy and dumbs down the whole process. But McKinley brought America into the modern era in which technology was changing lives and industry, and in which immigrants were becoming powerful voting blocks that had to be courted but also respected. All right, the 25th president, William McKinley, was born in Ohio in 1843, grew up in an economically deprived but very pious Methodist home. And from an early age, he absorbed values such as humility, hard work, devotion, and faith. He briefly attended college, but read widely. Even so, he once said that he learned more from people than he did from books, which is not really a reflection on his intelligence, but in fact probably added to his intelligence, or his intelligence quotient. McKinley came into his own in 1861, aged 18. It was the start of the Civil War, And when Lincoln asked for volunteers, made a call for recruits, McKinley responded immediately, and in a short time he grew very close to Rutherford B. Hayes, the general of the Ohio Regiment, eventually serving under Hayes as quartermaster and achieving the rank of major. In fact, McKinley preferred to be called the major his whole life. He felt he earned that as opposed to any elective office, and even his wife referred to him as the major, which is cute. McKinley fought at Antietam and often was in the center of the action. Years later, when his comrades wanted to nominate him for a Medal of Honor, he stopped the process. July 1864, as an example, then Lieutenant William McKinley was sent on a suicide mission across a Virginia battlefield, carrying orders for a certain regiment to withdraw, and quickly he charged across the field through cannon fire, through bullets, and a horse shot out from under him. He made it. He delivered the message, returned to General Hayes, who said to him, "I never expected to see you in life again." It's the type of thing you say to someone after, not before. They were very close. The McKinleys, in fact, babysat for Hayes' children in the White House during the Hayes presidency when Hayes had to travel. During the war, McKinley befriended a Jewish surgeon, Captain Daniel Mayer, and they became lifelong friends. And McKinley was also the end of an era. He was the last president who fought in the Civil War. If you think about it, those are always milestones. Last World War II veteran, Civil War, last Vietnam veteran. Today, in fact, there are no remaining candidates for the presidency who have even served in the military, if you think about it. I mean, Jim Gilmore is not a real candidate, but out of the 10, 12, 13 people remaining, none have served in the military, and that's rarely happened in the past, and certainly reflects on their qualifications. After the war, McKinley began to read law in a lawyer's office. That's the apprenticeship route to being admitted to the bar. And along the way, he met and fell in love instantly, he says, with Ida Saxton. At the time, she was involved with another man, but he unfortunately died of illness, and McKinley moved in. And Ida Saxton had a very difficult life, as if they were jinxed. They married in 1871. Their life was difficult. Their first daughter, Katie, died of scarlet fever at the age of 3. And during a period of less than 2 years, Ida lost 6 close relatives, including her parents, her grandparents, and daughter, plunged into a depression, exacerbated even more by a fall that caused brain damage, and she suffered from epileptic fits for the rest of her life. Often in public, she would shake and hiss uncontrollably, and when it happened in public, McKinley would just put a handkerchief over her face until the seizure passed. Their other daughter also died as an infant, leaving them without children. It was a very, very tough life. And he remained extremely devoted to her. It was something that people, because of the advanced reach of the media, the American people recognized, even though she couldn't always accompany him, and she was very demanding, was given to fits of anger as well. He was very patient with her, and he accepted the problems with great faith and without even a hint of scandal during their married life. And she nevertheless supported his political career. When McKinley was first elected to Congress in 1877, he took an office right, I mean, there was no congressional offices then, he took an office right opposite the room they rented in a Washington hotel so he can constantly check on her welfare. As a lawyer, he was very successful. He grew in wealth and in prominence, and he became a public figure as he plotted his rise. Fortunately for him, he remained connected to Rutherford B. Hayes, and McKinley was elected to Congress the same year, 1876, that Hayes won the presidency, and McKinley campaigned extensively for Hayes. If you think about it, his profile was already elevated, even as a first-term congressman, because of his closeness to the president. In Congress, partly because of his wife and partly because of his own nature, McKinley eschewed the party scene, the cocktail circuit that attracts so many politicians, and he spent his nights reading bills becoming an expert on house rules and an eloquent spokesman for the causes he believed in, primarily high tariffs. He felt they not only help business, but they'd keep wages high as well for the worker. And he supported less vociferously the gold standard. McKinley became so successful that Democrats targeted him again and again for defeat, mostly by gerrymandering his district, so he'd always have to run in unfriendly territory. Over the years, he lost twice because of that, but he always bounced back, and he had a very warm and winning way with people. In 1892, he was elected governor of Ohio, but in 1888 already, and again in 1892, he was being urged to run for president. In 1892, as we discussed a few weeks ago, against his will, his name was placed in nomination, and he won 182 votes at the convention against the sitting president, Benjamin Harrison, but that helped him in 1896 when he was perceived as the obvious front runner. How did that come about? Well, how's this for the modern presidency? When McKinley was a lawyer in Ohio, he successfully defended a group of miners and then met a political activist named Mark Hanna, who became probably the first real campaign manager, the Karl Rove of his generation. And together, they plotted how they would win the nomination and the presidency. They formed the very first field operation. Think of what's going on in Iowa tonight. They formed the very first field operation. They had supporters in every state reach out to the powers that would decide how the delegates voted. Remember, it wasn't like today when there are caucuses or primaries. Then there were delegates appointed by the party leaders, and basically they voted at the convention as the party leaders told them to vote. Not always, but for the most part. So he had people all over. He was able to reach out to major politicians in every state. When the bosses were reluctant to endorse McKinley unless he made patronage commitments, he went around them to the people, to the delegates, the people who would be delegates, the mid-level politicians. One boss later commented, "Everyone is against William McKinley except the people." McKinley himself traveled around the country, unprecedented, beginning in 1894, 2 years before the election, introducing the country to himself and not shy about discussing the presidency. Such had never been done before. He even ventured into the Deep South, which had become solidly Democrat, if only because the Democrats were suppressing the black vote. McKinley would target that black vote, and again, for the first time in history, even spoke before a black church in the South, Savannah, to demonstrate his fairness and his commitment to their welfare. All this took place 2 years before the 1896 Republican Convention, and McKinley was so successful, as was Hanna, advising him, that McKinley had the nomination locked up before the convention and won on the first ballot with almost 72% of the vote. Election of 1896, McKinley not only targeted every state, but he sought to broaden the appeal of the Republicans by reaching out directly to Catholics and to immigrants, meaning Jews and others, two groups that as yet did not interest the Democrats. In fact, the opposite was true. The Democrats were perceived as anti-Catholic and by extension anti-Jewish, and McKinley did something extraordinary for the time. There's an organization called the APA, the American Protective Association, that was virulently anti-immigrant and anti-Catholic. It had become a significant force in the 1890s. They represented the old forceful Protestant guard, and they demanded that McKinley not have a Catholic offer the invocation at the start of the Republican Convention in 1896. Assuming that McKinley would then ask a Protestant, but he didn't. He didn't ask a Catholic or a Protestant. For the first time, McKinley asked a Jew to deliver the invocation at a national political convention. It's not quite what the APA had in mind, but nonetheless, it was Rabbi Samuel Sale, Reform rabbi, born in Louisville in 1854. attended the rabbinical seminary in Berlin in the 1870s. There was a reform seminary there. And he became the rabbi at Shari Emeth in St. Louis, where he came to McKinley's attention. Sale served as the rabbi there, then rabbi emeritus from 1887 to 1937. 50 years. 50 years. So at the convention, Rabbi Sale said as follows. I'll just read part of it to get a flavor of the way they spoke and thought then. All merciful and most gracious Father, couldn't even say that to them, by the way. All merciful, most gracious Father, fountain of light and life, we seek thy presence and implore thy guidance in the toils and tasks of our earthly being. Thou who art enthroned in the heart of man and rulest in the destinies of nations, be nigh unto us now, and show forth thy wondrous ways in this assembly of thy people. Hearken unto thy servants, the bondmen of freedom, and pour out on them who have come to do thy bidding in the service of truth and honor. Listen to these words. The spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and strength, the spirit of knowledge and fear of the Lord. It's a pasuk from Yeshayahu, we read the Haftorah for Achon Shel Pesach. Make righteousness the girdle of their loins, and faithfulness the girdle of their hips. May thy grace, O God, come upon us, and do thou establish the work of our hands. Amen. Now, I synopsized the beginning and the end, but in the middle he also asked, listen to the words, he asked that, I quote, our beloved land, from the hundred-harbored main to the vine-clad hills of the Golden Gate, from the ice-bound north to the warm and sunny south, may go from strength to strength. What does that sound like? Yeah, America the Beautiful. It sounds like a lot like the lyrics of America the Beautiful, which had been published the year before, 1895. The music was borrowed from a hymn entitled, O Mother Dear Jerusalem. But you've seen what Sale was saying, echoes of From Sea to Shining Sea. Sale also said, let us not come to shame and grief by the worship of the gods of gold and silver, which sounds innocuous enough, but enabled him to thread that needle as carefully as William McKinley did in the great currency dispute. McKinley was against silver as a basis for currency, which could have cost him support in the West, but he was not overtly and vehemently so. In effect, he favored the gold standard, but he fudged the issue enough in order not to rebuff the Republican pro-silver caucus. The Democrats were not subtle or coy at all. I mentioned last time, it's very hard for us to understand the passions that were generated in the 1880s, 1890s, back in the day, about the currency issue, but it was over the top. The free silver crowd was the major issue in the election. The free silver crowd felt that adding silver would debase the currency, as you'd have more metal propping up the dollar, and cheap money would enable the farmers and the laborers to more easily pay off their debt, their mortgage, their loans, etc., since the currency would be worth less. So to their view, the gold standard was supported by big business, and Democrats thereby ran against Wall Street. Not for the first time, not for the last time. South Carolina's bombastic senator, Ben Pitchfork Tillman. We miss those names. Pitchfork Tillman was so named because he once threatened to gouge with a pitchfork that bag of beef, Grover Cleveland. So here, Pitchfork Tillman explained, if the Democratic Party doesn't adopt free silver, it ought to die, and I have a knife with which I'll cut its throat. He was a Democrat, by the way. One Democrat marching song ended, vote for silver and we'll all have stuff. You still hear that today in some form. And they insisted on fixing the market price for silver to keep it attractive. The counterargument was that debasing the currency would reduce property values, impoverish laborers and producers, especially if wages were not raised commensurately, and impair existing contracts, commercial and domestic and international. Think about it. He changed the currency. The dollar's worth less. It hurts trade also, but they didn't think about that. This major issue led to one of the most famous speeches in American life. The Democrats in 1896 had tired of Grover Cleveland, and so that year saw the ascent of William Jennings Bryan, who's the youngest presidential candidate ever. We think Rubio is young. Rubio's in his early 40s. Bryan then was 36 years old. Naturally, he was told by others to wait his turn, which is exactly what Rubio, Cruz, and others are told too. William Jennings Bryan was born in Illinois. He was a very devout Presbyterian. He was a lawyer and a powerful orator. He resigned from Congress the year before when he crossed the Constitution's age threshold to be president, 35, and he set about, much like William McKinley, to win the presidency. He too traveled. When the convention started, he wasn't even considered a potential nominee, but at the convention, he awed the assembled with a speech that became known as the Cross of Gold speech, strongly supporting the use of silver as a currency equal to gold, and thereby immediately winning rural support. William Jennings Bryan was tall and handsome, both clean-shaven. Take a look at McKinley. He was the only president among nine in a row not to have any facial hair, and he was very, very dynamic. A delegate said of Bryan, once he became more assertive at the convention, that he was like Saul among the Israelites, head and shoulders, mishichmo ulamalo, above the rest. And he stood before the convention, and he cried that the welfare of humanity was at stake in the struggle between his side, pro-silver, and those who wanted only a gold standard. And he ended his speech, "Having behind us the producing masses of this nation and the world, supported by the commercial interests, the laboring interests, and the toilers everywhere, we will answer their demand for a gold standard by saying to them, you shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." And for good measure, Bryan held his arms out as if he was being crucified and kept his arms there. It was great theater. It was also very worrisome to Jews. The silver crowd included not a few who made this a religious issue, denouncing what they called the hook-nosed Shylocks of Wall Street, and chanting, "Down with the Christ-killing gold bugs." They meant us. Bryan tried to counter this to little avail, saying when Jewish Democrats gave him a silver star of David, Bryan said to them, "Our opponents have sometimes tried to make it appear that we were attacking a race," when he denounced the financial policy advocated by the Rothschilds. "But we are not. We are as much opposed to the financial policy of J. Pyrmont Morgan as we are to the financial policy of the Rothschilds. We are not attacking a race. We are attacking greed and avarice, which know neither race nor religion." It didn't work. In the election, Jews flocked to the Republican McKinley, like Catholics and immigrants and the wealthy and the middle class and the urban voters, and a Republican majority was cemented for almost 36 years. Bryan matched McKinley's campaign, except that Bryan traveled across the country by railroad, the first time any nominee would do that. Hanna orchestrated McKinley's campaign, in which for the first time a candidate would speak, but only from his front porch. Every few days, groups from across the country would come, and McKinley would deliver a variation of the same speech, which the people then would take back to their towns. If you think about it, one reason why Americans always sour on their presidents the last 25 years is that they're too ubiquitous. We see too much of them. Well, McKinley tried to strike a balance between giving over his ideas, what he would try to do, and staying out of the public eye, which Brian was not doing. An estimated 750,000 people came to his lawn over approximately 5 months to hear him speak. And different groups were targeted, even women who could now vote for the first time in three states. Hannah also distributed McKinley literature in every state so people would know their candidate. An average of 18 pieces of literature per voter were mailed out or otherwise distributed, aided by the fact that McKinley raised $4 million to spend in the election, 10 times what Brian had. His acceptance speech at the convention was distributed by the millions, even translated into foreign languages, including Hebrew. That's what Rove writes, but I think he meant Yiddish, not Hebrew. Hebrew characters, in order to reach the immigrants. So in fact, Jews could read about McKinley's plan in their native tongue, Yiddish. In October, wheat prices went up, and that also undercut Brian's campaign claims. McKinley won a sizable victory, splitting the states 23-22, because you had out west, and all the states were pro-silver, and the South didn't let the blacks vote, so that was Brian's base of support. McKinley won 51% of the vote to Brian's 47%, but by margin of more than 500,000 votes, the biggest margin of victory in decades, 271 to 176 in the Electoral College. But as Brian noted after the election, a switch of 20,000 votes in six states would have given the election to William Jennings Bryan. But McKinley won 1.7 million votes more than any other Republican had won up to that time, and he ran what Karl Rove called the critical maxim of political campaigns. Politics is a game of addition, not subtraction. Bryan ran a campaign of subtraction against a number of groups, against the wealthy, against Wall Street, against gold supporters, and subtly against immigrants. Unlike Brian, McKinley never castigated or even condescended his opponents. So he attracted a wide base of support, immigrants, Catholics, labor unions, and a strong majority of Jews. So many phrases would enter the culture that we hear some of them until today. It was William Jennings Bryan who said, "Those who are not with us are against us." Sound familiar? George Bush used that in 2001. McKinley, quoting George Washington, "There should be no north, no south, no east, no west, but a common country." Well, that's Obama's speech from the mid-2000s. And William Jennings Bryan on election day, "It's all over but the shouting." That phrase lives on. Bryan would lose, but he'd be nominated for president and run a total of three times and lose each time. Also unprecedented in American life, he died in Dayton, Tennessee in 1925, just days after he had given his testimony in the Scopes Monkey Trial in Dayton, in which Bryan, who was a fundamentalist, supported the ban on teaching evolution in the public schools. He was one of the prosecutors in the case, and Clarence Darrow decided to call Bryan as a witness because he had portrayed himself as a Bible scholar, and Darrow made a fool of him. Bryan died just a week or so after the trial. As president, McKinley presided over an era of growth, prosperity, and security. He raised tariffs to create jobs, and then he lowered tariffs to boost trade. And his also was a very underrated presidency, because he had several accomplishments. He grew the Republican Party, and he really was a transformative president. He was angered by limitations on black voting, but there was nothing to do about it. Even the law in the South would not carry through on what the authorities in the South would not carry through what the law demanded. And McKinley was an early supporter of women's suffrage. He supported the right of women to vote generally. In retrospect, because of the untimely end to his administration, many of the policies that he set in motion were credited to his successor, Theodore Roosevelt, with whom he had an uneasy relationship. Now, it should be mentioned, McKinley was a person of humility, I said that before, but also great integrity. He was widely admired for the devotion he lavished on his invalid wife and for his force of character as well. He had a delightful way of achieving consensus, for which some criticized him as weak, but his cabinet secretaries would say he had a beguiling ability to raise a topic, not reveal his position, and guide the discussion until his position was the consensus position adopted. That's a good trait in a leader. As a young politician, he regularly sought the opinions of the people, and he always made himself accessible to the common man. And he was honest. In 1893, he was still governor, he was shocked to learn that because he had co-signed notes to help a friend get a loan in the 1880s, and the friend had disappeared or his business failed, that McKinley himself was on the hook for $17,000. He was fairly well off, he was willing to pay it, but when he returned home to Ohio from Washington, he learned to his distress that it wasn't actually $17,000, it was actually $130,000, because he had signed also blank notes, and his friend just kept borrowing money on those notes, and that was money that McKinley did not have. So he decided to resign as governor, leave politics, go back to work as a lawyer in order to earn the money and pay it back. But friends and supporters raised the funds, but McKinley could not tolerate a debt. He was a devoted Methodist, quite pious, a churchgoer, a hymn singer. He lived a life of faith and good works. Even his unit in the Civil War was known as the Psalm Singers, because they spent considerable time in Bible study and preaching. And his White House was clean, scandal-free, mostly dry. One commentator said of McKinley, the loving kindness of God was William McKinley's religion, and is completely devoid of bigotry. September 1897, just a half year after taking office, the ubiquitous Simon Wolfe, mentioned him every week, sounds like he lived 150 years, Simon Wolfe invited McKinley to attend the laying of the cornerstone at the Washington Hebrew congregation, and McKinley came with the whole cabinet, he spoke, and the chair on which he sat remains a treasured heirloom, plaque and all. President McKinley sat here until today. McKinley offered Simon Wolfe a number of positions, all of which Wolfe refused. When Wolfe gave McKinley a copy of his book on American Jewry, McKinley responded in writing and with eloquence, thanking Wolfe for the book, what he called his masterly treatment of the subject, and McKinley concluded, "No better class of citizens than the Jewish exist in our country, many of whom have been and are my personal friends." In 1898, McKinley appointed his war buddy Daniel Mayer as American envoy to Argentina, and he returned Oscar Strauss to the post that he had held in the 1880s, that of ambassador to Turkey. In 1900, he appointed Jacob Hollander, a young economist, as the first treasurer of Puerto Rico. Since then they've fallen on hard times, but Jacob Hollander was the first treasurer of Puerto Rico, a territory that the U.S. had just captured. Hollander at one time was the first Jewish chairman of the economics department at Johns Hopkins University. So the Puerto Rico appointment followed one of McKinley's great foreign adventures and marked a sea change in American life. More than any other president up to his time, it was McKinley who set America on the path to be a world power. In the 19th century, American foreign policy consisted almost exclusively of ensuring trade between countries, negotiating agreements and treaties, and making sure the sea lanes were not under any type of naval attack. And now something changed. Despite never traveling out of the country, ever leaving America, McKinley was not a novice in foreign affairs. Through reading and talking to people, he presided over the annexation of Hawaii and then the Spanish-American War of 1898. Now, to some, very controversial then, to some it was an unnecessary war. To others, it was a war that McKinley was pushed into because he was weak. Neither is really true. In 1898, Cuban rebels were fighting for their independence from Spain, and reports came to McKinley that they were being slaughtered, massacred, their fields and crops set on fire. American foreign policy and even the Republican platform in 1896 supported Cuban independence, and Americans were always leery of European involvement in this hemisphere. There were war hawks among them. The Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Teddy Roosevelt, for one, but McKinley was cautious. He had seen war up close and personal. And he said, I quote, "I shall never get into a war until I am sure God and man approve. I've been through one war. I have seen the dead pile up, and I do not want to see another. Peace is preferable to war in almost every contingency." Well, it was Trotsky who would later say to someone, "You may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you." Diplomacy failed, and McKinley felt that the U.S. could not stand by and watch the massacre of innocents. So McKinley sent an American battleship, the Maine, to Havana Harbor. It was blown up under mysterious circumstances. Spain was blamed for it, and Congress declared war on Spain. It was later determined that the explosion was internal, not caused by a Spanish attack, but nonetheless. It was the U.S.'s first declared war in almost 90 years. Soon, remember, Spain had holdings across the world. Soon after, Admiral George Dewey attacked Manila Harbor, the Philippines, conquered the Philippines, since then an American protectorate. In Cuba, there were a number of brief battles, but the Spanish forces were overwhelmed and sued for peace. The U.S. lost about 350 soldiers in combat, and almost 10 times that many from disease like malaria and yellow fever. But the battlefield casualties were so low, relatively, that each coffin coming home provoked great displays of patriotism. And McKinley, adding to the moment, had allowed former Confederate soldiers to fight as well, endearing him to the South. In the end, Spain relinquished the Philippines and Guam and Puerto Rico. Cuba became independent, and the U.S. paid Spain $20 million. McKinley became... Why do they pay? Why not? McKinley became the first president since Jefferson to project American power overseas, and the first ever to do it in a way in which the U.S. could build an empire like the Europeans had done elsewhere, even though neither McKinley nor Roosevelt really wanted an empire. And along with this, McKinley began building a two-ocean navy, and the U.S. became a military power. And it was McKinley who cemented then an American alliance with Britain that lasted now almost 120 years. Jews were very supportive of the Spanish-American War. Why? It's so interesting. Because of the enmity Jews felt towards Spain resulting from the expulsion that had happened just 400 years earlier. And also because it was good to fight for a country that acted morally and where Jews were respected as citizens, which was a novelty. Many Jews enlisted and fought. A handful even charged up San Juan Hill with Teddy Roosevelt and the Rough Riders. So when Roosevelt ran for New York governor a year later in 1899, Yiddish flyers were distributed across New York City, urging Jews to vote for the man who had defeated the hated Spanish. Every true Jew must and will vote for Teddy Roosevelt. It's Yiddish. Think Yiddish. And it went on. It was a proclamation. Spain was a historical proclamation. This is the flyer that was distributed in Yiddish. Spain was home to the Jews, and we made it wealthy. How did Spain reward them? Spain took away everything the Jews had, and she sent her Jews to the dungeons of the Inquisition and the fires of the auto de fe. The cruelty that Spain let loose did not remain in its own land. Spain brought it to the New World. until Teddy Roosevelt charged up San Juan Hill, there still rang in our ears the crimes and screams of Spain's brutality. Spain now lies punished and beaten for all her sins. Vote for TR. Vote to express your approval of Spain's defeat. Interesting. We have long memories. Zohar. Teddy Roosevelt was elected governor, and he rode that wave to become McKinley's vice presidential nominee in the election of 1900, in which McKinley won a smashing victory over Bryan again, and this time almost doubling his margin of victory. McKinley was even more popular with the people and a better president than he's given credit for. Well, remember from last time that the first American Zionist was the Christian preacher William Blackstone, who drafted the Blackstone Memorial calling for the reestablishment of a Jewish state in the land of Israel for restorationist purposes, speed up the second coming. More than 400 prominent Americans signed on to it, including then Congressman William McKinley. If not much happened while McKinley was president, it was mainly due to the lack of Jewish support for the idea. The reform in the Pittsburgh Platform of 1885 had not only accepted the validity of all religions, but had specifically renounced Shivat Zion as part of Judaism, declaring, "We are no longer a nation, we are a religious community that had no claim to Zion at all." As Herzl made his preparations for the first Zionist Congress, August 1897, in Basel, Blackstone sent Herzl his personal family Bible, all marked up and underlined with all the biblical references to the return to Zion. It's clear that Blackstone knew the Bible better than Herzl. It's not known how much Herzl was impressed by this. What surely meant more to him was that the Reform Movement denounced the first Zionist Congress. Many Orthodox Jews were opposed on the other end of the spectrum, and only a handful of American Jews participated out of 204 delegates that gathered. And I mean a handful, probably five or seven. In the United States, the joke went as follows. A rabbi was in the late 1890s. A rabbi was asked, "Are there any Zionists in America?" And the answer was, "Yes, there are two, a madman named Stephen Wise and a mad woman named Henrietta Jold." It was a bit of an exaggeration, but not by much. The Chicago Zion Society had been founded in the mid-1890s, but it was small and without influence. The Baltimore branch of Chovei Tzion sent one delegate to Basel. Within a year, all the branches of Chovei Tzion joined forces and later became the Federation of American Zionists, and that grew 20 years later to be the Zionist Organization of America. Membership in the Federation was 50 cents annually. By 1912, at that bargain rate, they had less than 12,000 members out of 3.5 million American Jews. Zionism was not popular, and no wonder McKinley was cool to the idea and did not get involved on a political basis. It was Isaac Meir Wise, the Reform rabbi we've mentioned a number of times already, who said in 1898, I think he died the next year, Wise said in 1898, Zionism was an attempt to create a thoughtless utopia. And he said, wrote, "It's a momentary inebriation of morbid minds and a prostitution of Israel's holy cause to a madman's dance of unsound politicians." Judah Magnus was fired from his teaching job at HUC, Hebrew College, because he was a Zionist. 20 years later, he would become the first chancellor of Hebrew University. Well, whatever the Americans did to Herzl was a success, as he noted in his diary. "In Basel, I founded the Jewish state. Were I to say this in public, I would be greeted with universal laughter. But perhaps in 5 years hence, in any case in 50 years hence, everyone will recognize it." And indeed, 50 and a half years later, the Jewish state was born. As part of his promotion of trade, McKinley attended the Pan-American Exhibition in Buffalo, September 1901, less than 6 months after he was sworn in to his second term. A Polish Catholic anarchist Leon Czolgosz, born in Michigan, shot McKinley twice on September 6th as the president was shaking hands. Czolgosz was set upon by the crowd. McKinley pleaded that the shooter not be lynched. He told his aide to be very careful how they broke the news to his wife, Ida. Czolgosz exclaimed, "I done my duty." I guess they were just against all government. Czolgosz was tried and executed 45 days later. Swift justice. Now, McKinley had Secret Service protection, and there was a fear of anarchists because of a number of assassinations already in Europe, but it was to no avail. And like Garfield, almost exactly 20 years earlier, McKinley suffered from poor medical care. The Pan Am exhibition was displaying a new device, an X-ray machine, but for some reason it was not used on McKinley. One bullet had been deflected by a button, but the other penetrated his abdomen and could not be located. McKinley was operated on like Reagan. He joked with the surgeon. He happened to meet the surgeon by chance the day before, and he said to the surgeon, "I didn't think I would need your professional services." But soon after the operation, infection, gangrene set in, and McKinley died 8 days later, September 14th, 1901. In his death throes, Ida sobbed, "I want to go too, I want to go too." McKinley replied to her with his last words, "We are all going, we are all going. God's will be done, not ours." Ida never again set foot in the White House. Teddy Roosevelt was sworn in as president in Buffalo, where a museum marks the spot. The national mourning was intense, as McKinley was a beloved president. He was a third of the four presidents to be assassinated in office, the last until John Kennedy, 62 years later. In the end, William McKinley righted the economy, and he did his best to heal social wounds, and he projected American power morally abroad, and he bequeathed to the nation Theodore Roosevelt, who would enforce America's role on the world scene and become the first president to endorse a Jewish state in the land of Israel. All that next time. I thank you all very much.